Greetings, lovely people of this planet. I'm Farida, your host of the Slow Dive podcast, a space for intentional listening, thoughtful reflection, and genuine connection. Together, we explore creativity, social impact, innovation, and community building through in-depth conversations with inspiring guests. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome you to a special edition of our roundtable series, Beyond the Archetypes. In this discussion, we will explore women's evolving identities across culture and life stages. In this episode, we'll explore the layered experiences of being a woman through the lens of culture, family, and pivotal moments of growth. From the archetypes of maiden, mother, and crone to the challenges of breaking free from limiting dichotomies, we're here to rethink and redefine the roles that shape us. We're joined by a dynamic group of women, thought leaders, culture makers, and creators who will share their stories and insights. Together, we'll illuminate the paths women traverse and inspire collective reimagining what it truly means to define oneself. This is the final roundtable of season one, and I couldn't be more excited to share this meaningful conversation with you. So let's dive in, shall we? Hello, ladies. Welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I am going to go down our roundtable and introduce each one of you and ask each of you a roundtable icebreaker question, and we'll just start right in. And we'll start with Shala Khan, the producer at Rising Tides Film in Toronto, California. Shala is a producer with 20 years of film experience. She works at Corus Entertainment, managing the rights of portfolios of Food TV, Nickelodeon, Disney, Hallmark, and HGTV. She's a feature film programmer for the Mosaic International Film Festival while working at TIFF and helping to promote films like Dukhtar, Donkey Head, Joyland, etc. She is now busy prepping for a surfing documentary out of Pakistan called The Surfer Boy of Bulaji. How are you doing, Shala?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Farida. Slightly cold, not wishing for the snow, but otherwise okay.
Shala, is there a flower that represents you? What is your favorite flower?
You know what? Actually, it is. So it all goes back to my name, which is Persian, Shala. So it's supposed to mean beautiful, like anything beautiful, right? Like beautiful. But it also means a rare black tulip. So when I heard that, I was like, oh, okay, that's going to be my signature flower.
So a black tulip named Shala.
Yeah. It was actually my grandfather who named me. So he was a poet. He was, you know, into how you have the South Asian men. So they were into literature and poetry. And he had this book of names. It's called Lughat. And it had meanings in it. So it's beautiful. But except here in Toronto, when I call for an Uber, and there are a lot of Persians living around here. So when they come, they get confused. They're like, are you Persian? I was like, no, I'm not. My name is Persian, but I'm not Persian.
You are South Asian, Pakistani?
I am South Asian, born, brought up in Karachi. My mom is from, well, born in Calcutta, moved to Dhaka, and my father was from Banaras and moved to Dhaka. So that's where they met, at the airport, so to speak.
Nice.
He proposed to her. My mother said, get lost. And then he proposed. It was get lost.
Oh my God, Shala, there's a script there for you to develop. I mean,
I know.
Produce another film, another feature. We need more of that. This is great.
Yeah.
Anyways, we'll get into one of your feature projects that you're working on, because we have one of our lovely authors here as well that your company is working with. So we're very happy. Moving down to our next guest, Sonia. Sonia is a novelist, essayist, and public speaker, a powerhouse storyteller. Her award-winning novels and essays and talks and amazing. Just look her up everywhere. She's everywhere. Her latest book, Unmarriageable, hailed as a gold standard of Pride and Prejudice adaptations, has wowed readers worldwide. It's a Financial Times Reader's Best Book of 2019 and a favorite of NPR, New York Public Library, and People Magazine, and was even named one of Georgia's books all Georgians should read. Sonia's work has been published in leading outlets like the New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and her acclaimed short stories have earned nods from Claudia Rankine, Longreads, and Vella. She also curated No Place Like Home, a striking collection on South Asian borders and identity. Her TED Talk, What Will People Say, unpacks cultural expectations, while her powerful address at the U.S. Citizenship Oath Ceremony, We Are the Ink, speaks to the real American dream. An inspiring educator, Sonia has taught creative writing at Emory, Oglethorpe, and around the world. Born in Pakistan, raised in Saudi Arabia and England, and now based in the U.S., Sonia brings a global perspective to her literary voice. Hello, Sonia. How are you?
Very well. I hope you are too. Thank you so much for having me back on the Slow Dive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, you're a fun person to have a conversation with. Always like getting those insights, you know? Is there a flower that represents you? What is your favorite flower, Sonia?
I'm going to give my answer that I gave in our previous interview, which is I know there's no one flower. I would say I like them all. I have not seen a flower that doesn't bring beauty and joy and scent to somewhere in the world for someone. And I hope I'm a little bit like that. Even if you don't like me, there might be something you might like about me or want to hear from me. So I think a big bouquet of hothouse, wild, cultivated, garden grown, by the riverside, whatever, every flower in the universe.
Oh, you're a bouquet.
I'm a mismatched bouquet, which still somehow makes sense somewhere or the other.
Nice. I love that answer. Yes. Okay. Well, thank you for joining us again. All right. Shauna Derby is the daughter of Trinidadian immigrants. Shauna is a former fashion designer turned filmmaker based in Brooklyn, New York. Previously, Shauna worked in post-production doing motion graphics for commercial and television. In 2021, she was awarded the Devery Freeman Memorial Award for screenwriting for her sci-fi horror feature Facsimile. In 2023, her sci-fi pilot, Clones, was a Circle of Confusion Writer Discovery Fellowship finalist, and her sci-fi action feature, Super Villainous, was a WGAE and Film Nation New York Screenwriting Fellowship finalist. In 2024, Super Villainous was also a semi-finalist for both the Writers Lab and the Almanac Screenwriters October Colony. She currently works as a development associate at the Department of Motion Pictures. Shauna has written, directed, and produced several commercials and shorts, but plans to make her debut feature in the very near future. And I can say I have seen her short film Canary Trap, and it was just amazing. I really loved it. Welcome, Shauna.
Thank you, Farida. I'm so glad you were there for the screening. Canary Trap took forever to make, and it was stress-inducing. And now we're in the festival submissions process and trying to figure that out. And oh my God, it's stress-inducing. So just stress.
But it's the positive stress, right? Like there's negative stress and positive stress.
Do not refresh Film Freeway. I just need to keep telling myself that. Like, log out, do not refresh. So, My producer, she'll tell me if we got in. Just wait for that surprise email. So,
yeah. Well, I know you're going to get a lot of positive feedback from that film. I really loved it. Really connected with it too. Great job, Shauna. If you were a flower, or if you are a flower, what flower would you be? You are a flower, but let's say, what flower would you be? And what's your favorite flower? Share with us.
I would go with alliums. Alliums are like onions and garlic and shallots, and they have these weird ball-looking thing where it's like just a bunch of stems of tiny flowers on the edge, and I just love those flowers. They're very weird, but wonderful, and you get onions and garlic and shallots out of them, and garlic makes everything better. It's like every time a recipe is like add 2 cloves, I'm like, I'm gonna do 5. Garlic's amazing, and
it keeps the vampires away. Garlic, right? So like, I'm like, you're in the horror space, man. Is that
I know? I'm like, I'm totally for the garlic not keeping the sexy vampires away, because
I love that.
I'm like, okay, something about fangs makes dudes way sexier. I don't know what it is, but you're suddenly like, well, I mean, he looked like a troll before, but suddenly he's kind of hot.
Well, now that we have all gotten to know a little bit about each other, we'll go to our first segment, Allyship as Women in Community. Can you share an example of positive allyship you've encountered recently? And what does it mean to be an ally?
Well, Farida, I think it was like 2 years ago, I worked on a short film called Trouble Connecting, which I did through Women's Weekend Film Challenge, which is now called Moonshot Initiative. But it was such an amazing experience where they put a team of women and women identifying filmmakers together, and we had essentially 3.5 days to make a film. And it was terrifying. It was the first time I ever worked with a co-writer. It was the first time seeing something I've written directed by someone else. And it was so great just seeing her perspective and the suggestions she made. Like, so she was like, we need to go as big as possible. And she found this amazing location in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And it was just like, wow, we did this in a couple of days. And it was just a group of women who had never met each other before made this film together. And I think that was such a great experience that I ended up working with several of the women again on my next short, Canary Trap, because I was like, I know they could do this. Like, they're not just capable, they go above and beyond and made something amazing. So that was really,
I
love that.
I think, yeah, I think allyships work, or allyship works differently when you're in the room together, like Shauna's saying. But also for me, it's always been equally, if not sometimes more important, when there's only one woman in the room, and yet she has to be an ally to everyone who's either being slut shamed or fat shamed or some shaming going on, or, you know, because staying, you know, I've often been in situations where culturally or otherwise someone says something, you know, someone's too dark or someone's too fat or someone isn't dressed appropriately and whatever. And of course, one always has the choice to, like they say, keep the peace and not say anything. I choose not to do that because I feel the invisible allyship is so important. The ones that you can't see, the stuff that's going on behind the scenes, which has its then butterfly effects and reverberation. So for me, that almost is so very, you know, when we're in rooms together, we all try to get along and try to be polite and try to be everything. But for me, it's equally important that when we're alone, when we have the opportunity to be an ally to the invisible people being bullied or whatever amongst us, women and otherwise also, to, you know, to always speak up and be there.
I like that. And I like how, I totally see that. And I think on set experience from what Shauna was talking about, being put together with a group of production crew of women who don't know each other in a very short amount of time, building that community around a project is a positive. But also what you're saying is very important too, the bystander effect, like where we have the opportunity to kind of spotlight and bring awareness to the injustice or discrimination or bullying behavior maybe. Shala, would you like to add to that? Give me an example of a positive experience you've had recently as an ally or an allyship?
I think recently, if I go back to, was when we had events that were happening in the world and it impacted the Muslim community especially. And my company had taken out a corporate letter saying that, you know, you have to be mindful about the people who work and who are of the Jewish faith, right? What they didn't realize was that that isolated the South Asian and the Muslims who were there, and we were afraid to speak up or even say anything or mention. And it was my boss, actually, who is she's born in Canada, but her family's from Trinidad, and she had my back, and I didn't even know. She actually went to HR and said that, please, can you be mindful? Because it's hurting everyone. It's not just one sect of people. It's hurting everyone. And I didn't tell her that this was affecting me, right? But it was impacting the way I was working. I think she noticed it. And the way I was spiraling down at work, she noticed that. And she took it upon herself. I found this out later, that she took it upon herself to let. And so they retracted the letter back and put it as an overall thing that, you know.
Great.
Border reach. So for me, that is, I've always felt that, yes, I've seen where women can be worst enemies, but I've also seen where women surprise you and they can also be your best friends or allies, as I like to call them.
Sonia, I'm going to ask this question because I know you create these wonderful worlds in your books. Kit, we talked about it a little bit earlier. Can you recall a moment in your life you felt excluded? And what was the experience like, and how did you channel that into your artwork, writing work?
Okay, so I first of all, I find it very interesting that you've asked me this particular question.
Oh, everybody.
No, starting with me, because I feel like this is the story of my life, which is, I think I should, you know, sometimes I'm like, I need to write a book called Othered and Othering and whatnot, because... you know, I think, you know, when you're a child and stuff, you don't know labels or words. You just have feelings. You know, you don't think, oh, I'm sensitive, or I can see nuance even as a child, or I'm perceptive to feelings, or someone else, like some other child might rush by someone crying on the street, but you're the child that somehow goes and asks, you know, what's wrong? Are you okay? So as children, we don't have that sort of vocabulary or that sort of worldview. And then we grow up and we realize that that we may be different, or that others are treating us differently. And like I said, because I have always been one, and my difference comes, I think, a little bit like that, that even in the playground and stuff, I was someone who would try to at least gravitate towards defending people being bullied. And when you're defending people being bullied, it so happens that you also start to be bullied. And sometimes what happens is that the original person being bullied suddenly is no longer bullied. And sometimes you see them becoming part of the group that is now bullying you. And because I grew up in England, in the 70s, 80s, you know, certain time period, and when things were perhaps not as politically correct, or people could just say a lot of things, which it's sometimes unkind to say. Kindness became very important to me. And I think I carried that as an adult then, to cut a very long story short. And I'm always othered. I've noticed I'm othered when it comes to Pakistanis, when it comes to the greater South Asian community, when it comes to different Americans, religious groups. I'm just automatically othered because I just don't fit, like that mismatched bouquet. I wasn't even, you know, being cute about it. I've always been mismatched. But then what I've done with that, I think automatically, is that in my characters, without even realizing it, my characters, most of them reflect their experiences of being othered, which either then goes into trying to be part of exclusive or inclusive. And kindness, I think if you're othered enough, or if you've had enough losses, you sort of learn that there are two choices in life. You either become bitter because of those, or you become better. And by better, I mean as someone who tries not to inflict those same hurt on other people. So in a lot of my books, I've noticed, because I've been writing since decades now, is that a lot of what the characters are trying to learn is whether they've become bitter or better, and why. And how that ricochets between in the novels and in the rest of my work and everything. So, yeah.
So, and I'm going to ask also Shauna, because I know she's also a storyteller and filmmaker. Shauna, where in your life have you felt excluded, and what was that experience like, and how have you channeled that into your works?
On top of having immigrant parents, I went to elementary school in Toledo, Ohio, where I was often the only Black girl in the entire grade level. And then we moved to Corpus Christi, Texas, where I was often the only Black girl in the entire grade level. Eventually in high school, there were other Black girls, but I rarely had classes with them. A lot of them were girls that played basketball or other sports, and I was the one that like played tennis for ninth grade, and then like I was the one that liked all, you know, The Cure and Nine Inch Nails and stuff like that. So I've spent a lot of my life being like the black girl or the girl with parents with the foreign accent. I was often asked if my parents were Jamaican and had to explain that there are other islands out there in the Caribbean. Jamaica is not the one giant island every black person comes from. It was quite the experience, but I feel like within my writing, there has been a lot of my sitting down and observing other people and trying to put in what I've learned watching others and how they react to me, how they react to each other. And it also forced me to be more empathetic and like consider other people's experiences, because it's like often I experience people not considering me or my experience. So I think the sad part of being the other is you learn that you shouldn't other other people. You need to be more open because you want people to be open to you. So it is the putting out in the world what you want to get back. So I think that's had a big effect for me.
Do you feel like, would you have taken, and this is for anybody really, but like specifically creatively, because I'm speaking from a creative POV right now. Do you feel like those early experiences of being othered or excluded or bullied or maybe, you know, just picked on kind of drove you to create, and that just became like a healing process or a way to answer or get back at that early childhood experience or make sense of it or make understanding of it? Like, how do you, and this is just an open-ended question, like, where do you feel like that plays into where you are now with your works?
What I see with a lot of groupings, having grown up in different cultures, international schools where there were, you know, many United Nations student bodies, but also Pakistan for a while. And then coming to the U.S., I came for college and met a lot of immigrant brown, you know, South Asian people who were immigrants like me, but I'd grown up in different spaces. I'd grown up in more multicultural spaces, whereas the brown kids over here had grown up in predominantly white spaces, per se, which was not my, didn't reflect my experience. But what it took some time to realize it, but, you know, I saw that the racism or the stuff that the brown girls or boys or people who had grown up in a predominantly white space, they saw things as white, us and them, and the white people also, you know, that there was the othering going on racial terms. But me having grown up in an international school, number one, I quickly learned as a child, it's just how you process things, that it's not the Nigerian or the American or the British or the whatever person, the girl who's mean, Wendy's mean or so-and-so's mean or Susan's mean or Fatma's mean. You know, you learn to individualize very fast rather than just create a group. But then when I went to Pakistan, suddenly everyone was brown. You know, everyone looked like me. So what I quickly learned was that, oh, the othering here in this space is happening in terms of class and status, money. So the thing is, when you have a multiracial, multireligious group, per se, it's so easy to other each other based on these bigger criteria. But then suddenly when you're in the same space as everyone who looks like you, and I think Kamara might be able to speak to this, because England is so fraught with class and status. And for post-colonial countries of British Empire, that still very much stands also. I think if there's one strong legacy along with class divide on linguistic basis, another thing British Empire at least left to its colonial countries, post-colonial countries, is the British class system. It is alive in these countries. So I saw those spaces very much, the classism, then the racism, and how othering works in between these spaces also. And some, because, you know, as we see in the world today, or at least the American sphere, while people are like, well, how come people voted so-and-so and against their interests? Because they're seeing their othering and othered based on sometimes what they're seeing and the groups that they affiliate with, which might not be the same as the class that they affiliate with. And it's just very, and I like to bring that to my writing. In fact, all of my writing is about the boundaries and the borders between class, race, but, you know, all of these in-between nuances and stuff and how these two relate. And it's just utterly fascinating to see how people other and keep other.
Yeah. I think what you just said, the socioeconomic systems, and definitely I also do think there's still a lingering effect of colonization on those countries, where it's like it's so enforced that even when the colonizers are not there anymore, it still permeates within our culture, our street names, or that. And second-handedly, not knowing it, maybe unconsciously, we pass that on even in my own American experience. I see that within first-generation South Asian Muslim American people here in America. I was born here, but I also kind of see, like, I like to say I have a very diverse group of friends, different religions, different nationalities, different cultures, different faiths, all that, right? But I don't see that as regularly within South Asian communities, in my experience, and I'm not going to speak to all South Asians. I see that even here, that we all kind of like to cluster around likeness because like attracts like. We feel comfortable, familiar, but how does that prevent us from understanding others?
So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that point up because I grew up in an environment, I grew up in Pakistan, but I was always, because my father, he worked in cotton. So he worked with a lot of Europeans, American, but a lot of foreigners. So there were European, Japanese, Brazil and everything. So I, from a very young age, I was exposed to that. And they were all the males, some of them females. And they, when we went to Belgium, like they were extended family. Like I have traveled from a very young age, like I was 6 months old. So when I came to the States, I came with that mindset. I mean, I knew that racism existed or whatever, but I think I grew a thick skin because of that, or because, you know, even my mother, because like when I was growing up, we were exposed to, like I said, we were dark skinned babies because we went on a mother, whereas my father was, you know, lighter skinned. And so we could feel that in our, what we call in our dadiala, cousins, where if my father was not economically above them, we would have been overshadowed. But because he was economically above them and he was exposed to, so, you know, they couldn't tell us much, but we would hear whispers. But we learned to grow a thick skin because of my mother. And when I came to college, I think I came with that same mindset where we were exposed to different cultures, right? Like my father said, even if they don't speak English, learn how you play with those kids and stuff like that. So I think I was just naturally attracted to, I had Swedish, I had from the Caribbean, I had from the Emirates, I had like, so it was open. But I had, it was interesting, the boys from Pakistan, they would be like, why are you wearing a dress? Why are you not sitting and talking with us? And they told one of my friends that, I don't know why her father sent her here to study, because she's going to go back, get married, and look out for the kitchen. So she came panicking for me. She was a young Japanese girl, and she's like, Shala, is this what's going to happen to you? And I was like, who told you that? And then I went gunning for these boys because I was like, did I tell your mother that you had a live-in Colombian girlfriend who is now living in with your neighbor because your mother's there to visit? I said, what's it to you? So anyway, I grew up with that mindset. So I battled it. And when I came to Canada as well, so like you said, you have the hyphenated that Pakistani, Canadian, Muslim. But I was very clear. I was like, yes, I straddle both worlds. But I'm very proud of my Pakistani roots. It has a lot of problems, but I want to educate. But like you said, understand other people. Like, unless you make friends with them, you'll never understand, right? Like, what what happens with what happens in an Indian background? What happens somebody who's Jain, somebody who's a Buddhist, somebody who's Jewish, somebody, and I think that led to having a wide variety of people in my circle over here.
Yes,
where I made a conscious decision not to just stick to one.
We have this thing, and I'm going to just start with the very bold question. Some people say it's beauty privilege. Some people say it could be sexual objectification. Where have you noticed in your life, past or recently, that you were treated differently because of your femininity or your beauty or your outward experience? Or recently, if you can just share on that. I know it's a bold question, but we'll just lean into it.
I'm going to jump in real quickly just to say that because it happened so very recently, I tend to dress very feminine. You know, red lipstick, jewelry, you know, flowy dresses, whatever. But I think that's very much part of the Pakistani way I've grown up, which is the chiffons, the silks, that we're a very dress-up culture, even if you're going to the grocery store. And I still do that. Even I'm at the grocery store and people are like, you know, people will be like, where's she going? Even if I'm at home, I like it. It makes me happy. But it so happens that in the white American sphere, the concept of trad wife, traditional wife, has come up. Mm-hmm. And apparently they dress in the more flowy dresses and the more feminine sphere too. And no one in my culture, Pakistan or South Asia, would hear me and look at me and think that I am some feminine, dainty, demure, you know, creature. And just again, the marginality and the interesting boundary and borders and where I find myself within there. Whereas looking at me, someone would think I'm very conservative and very, you know, trad wifey and stuff, but I am not. So it's just been just to bring up, you know, what it means to be a woman or present as a woman and femininity versus feminism, which is what I like to write about. Also, the interceptions and everything between those two words, because I'm feminine, but I'm feminist also. And, and sometimes that can confuse a lot of people because they'll look at me, she must be all girly girl and, you know, good wife and everything. And I'm a good wife, but what does good mean and to whom?
So. Exactly. I saw Shauna, did you want to jump in?
Well, I was going to jump on what Sonia is saying, is that this whole trad wife trend, it's like a traditional upper class American wife, because that opportunity to stay at home with the kids and bake when you feel like it and, you know, have some chickens for funsies was not open to middle class, lower middle class, working class families, like not even at the turn of the century, like the turn from the 19th to the 20th century. Black women, Asian women, Latino women, they've all been working, and white women have been working too. It's like this whole idea of women entered the workplace during World War II is like, well, it's a certain class of women entered the workplace. Yeah, my mother at the time, she was working in a hospital, so she had weird hours. But yeah, it's like this whole trad wife thing. It's definitely such a class thing, especially when you see these women online, like the lives they're living, like, no middle class family can do that.
To everybody.
Yeah, but it's not
relatable.
Shauna, I think though that from what I've seen sometimes or what I've experienced in my life, my mother is a doctor, so she's worked her whole life. And yet, as I see in more traditional cultures, for me, the whole being a trad wife or trad anything is not so much whether you're working outside the house, or even if you're inside the house, you're working, especially if you're a U.S. suburban, you know, homemaker. But for me, it was always a mindset. Like, you could out earn your husband and everything, but the mindset was he's still the leader. Men are superior, men are everything. So for me, the whole where I say that one can present through one's clothes and appearance and style and stuff as some sort of traditional and yet not be, because your mindset is different. And so that's where I find with where a lot of these trad wives seem to be very confused with the baking and with the more superficial things. It's more their mindset. I've met some women who, again, might, from their appearance, you would think that they would not have a traditional mindset at all. And yet they do, even though when you look at them. So it's sometimes it's just interesting to see the appearances people have, what they wear and how they wear themselves, but how they think might be very contradictory to what we might assume, you know?
Well, an anecdote in a Japanese series that I saw and I found hilarious is this girl, she's a temp worker and she's trying to find work. And she just does housework for this Japanese bachelor. And somebody says, you know what? What if you calculate how much it costs to do housework and stuff like that? That's a job, right? And go get a contract marriage, but do it in a way where you're contracted to, you're married for a certain period, but you get paid to do the housework. And I was like, that's so fascinating, because you have in South Asia, you know that it's nonstop for females when they're working. I mean, like they come back from work, then it's the kitchen, then it's the kids, then it's the husband. It's like, when do you get the me time? Like the feminine part is that you know the power that you have and how to use it and to be strong. And like you said, it's okay for me to say I earn more than my husband. It's okay for me to say I bought the house. My husband didn't, or a partner, or whatever the case may be, you know? So I think now the roles in the South Asian households are changing as well.
This is the topic I write about, novel Unmarriageable. All my work is about this topic. I will say that whereas the women are definitely, because I saw my mother as a very high earner growing up and stuff, also my aunts, etc. Nevertheless, and I think it's still many times applicable today, the women definitely are more educated, maybe out earning, maybe everything, and may also be, like you're saying, claiming their authority and their agency on this, that we are doing this and we have all that. But oftentimes it's the people around them who nevertheless want them to shrink. You know, it's one thing to say, I am smart. But if everyone else is around you is saying, yeah, you may be smart, but you're still, you know, not as smart as your husband, or you shouldn't be as smart as him, or you're not as smart as you think. There's, you know, we were talking about allyship. And that's where sometimes I see, you know, in allyship works so differently in different spaces. And in home spaces, in South Asian home spaces, and not just South Asian, I think the more traditional home spaces, because I see Japanese women having this a lot, sometimes Korean women, and women from the more Italian cult, you know, the more Jewish women, the more Mormon women, the more traditional spaces and cultures and stuff, still everyone across the board struggling with self-respect, which I think women are gaining by the minute every day, but then that translating into respect from your household and the larger community also. But also, shall I want to say that in countries where domestic help is relatively more affordable than it is in the US for the middle class or upper middle class, etc. The class stuff comes in there also. You know, a lot of times domestic help is, it's the women who are working and earning, and the people who are, and the women who are employing them do not have an income. So suddenly you have an income and no income coming across in class terms. And yet who is respected more? The woman who's earning an income because she's cooking or cleaning in your house versus the woman who doesn't have an income, but yet has the more disposable income through her husband. So those class issues and where respect is and who's to be respected play a huge role also in different cultures.
Yeah. Some of the privileges, I think, of being economically privileged, you kind of can be in every space and no one says anything. And I think that comes from South Asian culture a lot. Like, for example, ideally, and this is, I don't speak for all women, ideally, you know, women, a lot of women don't subscribe to gender norms. But I also think there is such a thing as, with the whole topic of trad wife, there is something unconscious misogyny or shaming women to have choices, to be in their, to be in a traditional role. So what is wrong if you want to be a stay-at-home wife? Nothing wrong with that, right? I see a lot of judgment from both places. When you're married, you can, and let's say you're not in a traditional role, 9-to-5 job, and you're not building a business, you're not doing something, but you're still like providing for your children, keeping the house managed, whatever that is for you and your family, what you guys decide. It's seemed like, oh, you're a stay-at-home mom, that there's judgment from women who work. Do you see that judgment within women sometimes? Like if someone wants to bake sourdough bread and can jams and do that, it's all fine with me. And if you want to have a 9-to-5 and hustle, all fine with me. I respect all of it. What are your thoughts on that? Because where we start judging each other based on the roles and spaces. And before you answer, what identities and spaces are you in? Like I am a, I'm an over 40 divorced woman with cats. That's a meme somewhere on the internet right now. But I once was a married woman and all that. So that's the label that's given to me by society. And automatically people are like, okay, that's it. That's all you can do. Or that's where you fit in.
It's such a complicated thing. Cause like I'm a mother to a teenager and it's so bizarre. Cause it's like, I didn't completely stop working, but I was working part-time. I definitely could not financially support myself while my son was younger. And it in a lot of ways hampered my career because it's like I am 10 years, 15 years behind women that are in their 30s. And it's just like I sometimes look at them and I'm like so jealous that they're like, they have gotten so much further than me. There's just this complicated aspect of there is no right answer, but every answer somehow benefits men. It's so frustrating because it's like guys end up okay in all of these situations.
I think in the US or in cultures where there's not a lot of affordable domestic help available, which is, you know, a lot of the times the case in the in America, women end up having to do the job of 8 million people. At least that's what I found. Suddenly you're the chauffeur and you're the cook and you're the homemade, you're doing the laundry, you're doing everything. You're going out doing the grocery shopping. And then you yourself often want to have a career also. You know, you just don't want to be this. You want to be able to own your own. You don't want to be financially dependent on anyone, et cetera, et cetera. So you end up doing a lot of jobs this, you know, and I have to say quickly here that the role of trauma also plays a role. It's also, you know, I see women who are coming from more traumatic families or backgrounds where they weren't able to fulfill their dreams or do what they wanted to do. And then they struggled towards emotional and mental health. And that lag of 10, 20, 25 years where suddenly they wake up one day and they've noticed that the women who come from more emotionally healthier families or cultures are way ahead of them than those of us, and I include myself in that, who had to fight for our emotional health and often navigate it ourselves because there were no resources available. And so just to piggyback off what Shauna was saying, you know, a lot of times for different reasons, we do feel like we're behind in some respects, and that interests me also. And I'd like to hear what everyone has to say when it comes to what does being behind even mean when we've brought up children and we've done the job of, we've done 50 jobs, we've done the children also and trying to have a career and everything. So why do we feel like we are behind in ways also? You know?
Yes, that's a good question. Why do we feel behind? And I know Shayla wants to answer, so I'm going to go to Shayla. What does it also mean when you're not raising a child and you're behind? Like, we can discuss that too. Vishela, I know you wanted to add to this.
No, to piggyback on what Shauna and Sonia were saying is before I had career goals. I always was. And when I got married, I was very specific that I'm going to work in television. And nobody can say that's my choice. If I don't want to work, it's my choice. If I want to work, it's my choice. Nobody can tell me that I won't work. So I think we also are so ingrained or taught that way that where we don't put ourselves first, because it's always thought to be selfish. You're a mother, So, you know, you have to look after the child. Your husband is there, you have to. So where is it your time? Like where, when I came to the West, that's what I saw, that, you know, they put themselves first, the mental health or things. I mean, it may not be true of all societies in the West, but I did see, and I thought, oh, are they being selfish? But I think it's come to the point now where I've had a child and I've, you know, gone through so many years of marriage and everything. It's like, huh, no, it's not selfish. You do have to take time out for yourself. And then on the career path, like somebody said, oh, you cannot have a career. And I was adamant that I do want a career and still have a child. But when I was in Pakistan, I felt that I was way behind my colleague, my male colleague, who now heads a channel, because I was away and he was my junior and I was away. And it took me such a long time to come back into the workforce and have that mindset, because you're trying to be a mother and balancing that and not work late and not, you know. So, and I'm like, now at this age, when I moved to Canada, I was like, I have a very short period of time. I became ambitious. I said, my daughter will find ways, but I need to get back on track to my career. And I think it's coming to the West that helped me, give me that perspective.
I love that. I think women, we can do it all. We can do it one thing. We can do two things. We may just go our own path. It's totally fine. But society will always put those expectations on us, unfortunately. And we just have to kind of course correct.
Go back to your talking about how women are told to find a provider. And it's like this whole idea of you're supposed to find a provider when you're like in your 20s. It's just like, a 23-year-old girl is not going to find a 23-year-old provider. And it's just kind of this whole, I feel like this is another thing where men end up getting to take advantage, because it's like the only providers are these dudes in their 40s and 50s that no woman in her 40s or 50s wants, who show up with their, oh, I think you're so mature for your age, and I can provide financially. And it's just like, so many of these expectations, especially for young women, just set them up to be victimized, and then also set them up to feel like they're not doing enough, no matter how much they do.
I think, though, that for me, it all comes down to the word choice. If you made your own choices, you can live with the regrets of those. Unfortunately, I think in too many traditional cultures, even today, but especially when I was growing up, there was no agency and choice. There was a lot of emotional blackmail, a lot of emotional pressure to live a certain traditional way. And the carrot, like I say in the novel Unmarriageable, my protagonist Alice says, she tells her mother, who wants, you know, all girls to get married as soon as they're born, you know, the carrot was, do everything you want to do after you get married, travel after you get married, have a career, you know, do this, do that. Everything was, once you get married, then apparently it was Disneyland and it was Oz and everything was open to you. And often then you got married and you're suddenly dependent on someone else's income. So if you wanted to travel and your provider cannot provide the income for you to travel, or for you to be a fashion model at home, or for you to do whatever the hell you were told you could do once you got married, suddenly you're stuck and you have never been encouraged to have your own income or your own career, whatever. And it's a very, you know, which is where for me, this whole trad wife in the US is a bit of a joke, because when you are presenting as a trad wife in baking, and you have not come from a culture like I have and many of us have, where you are forced into actually living as a trad wife, which is being completely financially dependent on your husband for everything, and then being very grateful for whatever that roof and whatever is provided. It's not just dress up and wearing flowy dresses and baking. It's an economically subservient position. And if you did not choose that, the regrets and the anger and the resentment you have towards those who steered you that way, towards the culture that put you in that position, and then towards yourself, because increasingly we are taught and told to take responsibility for our own lives. And as I say in my TEDx talk and just generally, I find that very troubling because some of us didn't get to make our own choices. And now to suddenly be responsible for the choices and the lives that we find ourselves in is a very, very difficult, emotionally difficult place to be in. And younger women in their 20s and stuff, I think a lot of us who see these trad wives on TikTok and stuff and we start screaming about, don't do that, don't do that, is because, you know, sometimes the provider does not provide, right? Financially or emotionally or in any way. And by the time you realize that, you can be 50 years.
Or they provide, but that's all they provide. And you don't get a genuine partnership because you're so young or they're so old. There's like that whole power dynamic as well. Because when you're dependent on someone, like you said, like you're just grateful for whatever it's given. And like you said, it's on a spectrum, right? Like I will say to you, my mother was, who just recently passed away, she was the first woman to work and support her family because her father, they were refugees to Pakistan after the partition. And my mom went to the workforce to support her family. And she was considered not marriageable because she was working in a pharmaceutical lab in Karachi, Pakistan, and who's going to marry a woman who's supporting her family. And she got all her younger siblings married. But that same woman who sent all her family to America, when she came here and she met my dad, who was younger than her, my father was 5 years younger. Well, that was, oh my God, scandalous. Like your husband is younger. And then she had me and she still told me, shadi ke baad, after you get married. And I was born in Chicago. Shadi ke baad. Like, and when you said resentment, Sonia, trust me, that was something I would always like get back to my mom at. May God bless her soul, and I love her dearly, and she's gone. I would be like, you know, I was a rebellious firstborn daughter of an immigrant, which I was like that role, trying to figure out American culture, being born here, then also dealing with your parents' culture. And then being like, where do I fit in?
Yeah. And I have another word I absolutely resent or phrase these days is the whole gold digger thing. I mean, when you come from a culture where your husband is supposed to provide everything for you, apparently then if you look at bank balances and stuff, you're a materialistic gold digger and that's a sin. But when he's looking at how thin you are and how pretty you are and everything, that's still okay. So, you know, it's just never a fair system. Women are gold diggers, even though in a traditional marriage you're supposed to be dependent on his income. But if he makes nothing, that makes you noble because you marry. It's infinitely interesting how all these dynamics are always, like Shauna said, always serve a certain gender.
I just wanted to add is because this is a slice of life story that I wanted to. So it's my cousin who's much younger to me, and he works and he's got a wife and a daughter. And, you know, he lost his job, so obviously he racked up debt on the credit card because he had to pay for, back in Pakistan, you have to pay for school fees, right? And books and stuff like that. And the wife who used to work gave up and, you know, fine. And she decided to look after the child and everything. But now the husband is struggling and she refuses to work, you know? And we're not judging, but sometimes I would like to ask her, like, you know he's struggling. He's trying to provide for the best. Homera said that even men, you know, like, they're struggling that where will I get the next meal from? Where will I pay for the child's school fees, right? And they're struggling. I can see them struggling. And I think the only income that they have is that they're lucky enough. My father-in-law was very clever enough to have a house built next door to put it on rent, right? And that is a rental income that comes. Kind of thing. And I'm like, I don't ask them, but I was like, shouldn't the woman step up? Or is it the man's thing to figure out that, oh, I need to figure out where the income is coming from? The wife doesn't need to.
I'm going to answer this, and this might be very controversial, but again, I'm going to go back to the root of the root of the root and say that in a traditional culture where you have been taught while you're in the womb also, that you are going to be the mother and the wife and the thin one and the look good and the everything, and your husband will provide for you, but you are also providing, because let's not make the mistake and say that she's not working when she's in the house. She's working a lot. And even if you have a house full of domestic staff, you are managing that staff. Someone is dealing with the servants fighting and, you know, all that stuff. So it's not that no one doesn't work. Let me also say here, the trophy wife and the gold digger also works very hard. And she works by going to the gym and making sure that she continues looking like a trophy. Again, my views are very controversial, TikTok, Instagram and stuff do, you know, I'm all, but I don't think no one doesn't work. Everyone works in their different way. But again, in traditional cultures where the gender work has been so clearly categorized, to suddenly, you know, the man is not giving birth and nursing and breastfeeding and doing the million other things that the woman has already done. And now suddenly she's supposed to step up and earn a living also because she has to help you, whereas you have probably never helped her. Not just that, given certain traditional cultures, never appreciated, never acknowledged all the work she's doing, never whatever, probably told her, you just sit at home, what do you do? There's a lot of dynamics that play into that. Now, I don't know the specifics of your particular relatives, but I just see that sometimes women feel that they're already putting in a lot of work. And now suddenly having to, it's one thing when you choose to go out and work, right? I didn't just want to do the home work. I wanted to also have a separate, my own career. And writing seemed the one thing that the life led me to. I wanted to be an actress, but because of respectability issues, I was not allowed to take any opportunities. No, it's true. I was offered many roles acting from Bollywood, from Pakistan, from whatever. My father said no. TEDx talked about this, huge upset even right now. But I started writing because it was something I could do at home while I looked after my children. And I writing unfortunately doesn't pay a lot. I didn't realize that. But my point is that I think for a lot of women who have grown up in these traditional cultures where the man does this, the woman does this, and the woman is doing that, it can be a little bit resentful to suddenly, when you're a certain age, be told that now the man can't do the thing that you've been told he's always going to do. And now you have to step up too. Some women do step up. And that's very nice of them. And some women don't choose to, but I don't think that it should be expected either in cultures which pride themselves over gender divisions.
Yeah, this conversation definitely has, we went into different directions, but very important points because it all affects our experience. I also think it's a class thing, Sonia. I think if you have access let's just say, for example, a lot more assets and resources, then maybe it is easier to take on a passion career or that while and have everything. Whereas, you know, maybe if you're in a certain survival situation where you have to both work to pay the rent or pay the mortgage to put food on your table, then it's not a luxury of having a career and being a stay-at-home mother and then having your passions and your hobbies. Now it's more of like, okay, well, we need to survive and we're going to partner up and survive. So it's once again, these questions and these scenarios play out socioeconomically for all of us, because I think if all of us are given resources, hey, I want it all. I want the comfort of pursuing a career that I'm joyful every day, but I also can lean back sometimes and take it easy and not carry the stress, and also make sure I get my Pilates class in every day, get my nails done every week, and also like do that. But not all of us women have those access or resources. And that's where I think this is why this conversation is illuminating, because we can identify that, right? And agency in that. Well, we didn't get to everything. Sorry, guys. We didn't get to everything today. We have more. We have another roundtable with more segments. But there is one question I will ask each of you to close out today. And what does it mean to be beautiful? And what do you think is beautiful about you?
It's so hard to, because I feel like there isn't any one thing that makes a woman beautiful. There are so many different aspects. There's kindness. There's persistence. There's giving no shits. There's so much. Like, I look at what so many women have done, and I just like, I want to be like them. Like, I want to accomplish so much. And I think it's our difference that makes us beautiful. It's like, if every woman had the same beauty, it would be boring. So
what was yours? Not aluminum. Alliums.
Yeah, alliums, yes.
Aluminum? No, that's foil. Shala, what does it mean to be beautiful, and what is beautiful about you?
Okay, I'll go to the superficial one first. I think what's most beautiful about me is I've been always complimented on my eyes. So people say it, I have not. I barely put makeup on, as you can see. I think it's an upbringing of being raised in a convent school. But I'm comfortable in my skin without makeup. But yeah, people have complimented me on my eyes. So I guess that and the smile. So I guess that's it. But I think I've seen this. I've seen how my grandmother aged so gracefully, and white hair and all. At the end of the day, beauty fades. It is what you are as a person. And I think that is most important, because you can be the most beautiful person, but if you're going to be a, pardon my language, a bleep, 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 people are beauty fades, and they'll remember you that, oh, you know, she was beautiful, but she was bleep, 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 bleep. And that's what they'll remember you. And I think I'd rather leave a legacy of people remembering that, oh, she helped out, or, you know, she was kind, or she had empathy, or, you know, something. We're not angels, let's put it that way. But we try to do what we can, right, to a certain extent. And I think that's what, at the end, is the legacy that you leave behind.
Yeah, beautiful. And yes, your eyes are beautiful, Shala. Pretty eyes, pretty smile. Sonia, what does it mean to be beautiful, and what is beautiful about you?
I think... In my novel Unmarriageable, I have talked, because the mother in that is very, very beauty conscious, extremely so. And then the protagonist, Alice, is the opposite. And the catch line of the novel is books before looks, books over looks. So, you know, because the novel is almost a meditation on, are looks more important for a woman, or is her mind, her smarts, her intellect, her, you know, her, all of that more important? And, I don't know. Each to their own. Each woman thinks of it differently. I think for all of us at different times, you know, someone gets a pimple and it's the end of the world. Someone fails an exam and it's the end of the world. Nothing is ever the end of the world. I think for me personally, what I enjoy about myself, or at least I've learned and taught myself to enjoy myself, is I like clothes a lot. I like most of us, like a lot of us in the world, how to enjoy my clothes and dressing up on a budget, how to be stylish, what that means to me, you know, all everyone, the glasses. Some of us are wearing glasses here, and we're all wearing different glasses. Some of us have long hair, some of us have no hair, some of us have, you know, we've all chosen different hairstyles, and we all carry ourselves in different ways, you know, all those little things. I find those things, those quirks, very beautiful. But at the end of the day, for me, the most beautiful thing is critical thinking. It's reading a book. For me, it's the most beautiful aspect of anyone, because looks can fade and all sorts of things can go, but with each age and stage, it's how do you critically apply what you've learned. So for me, the most beautiful thing in the world is a good conversation, which I've been so privileged and blessed to have with all of you. So
thank you. I love that, Sonia. First of all, I'm going to bring this to attention, Sonia. I never like to interrupt you, because I'm like, I can see the flow. I'm hearing all these great insights and truth bombs. I'm like, yes, yes, yes. Where's my reaction button? You're wearing a Mona Lisa scarf and a shawl. There's Mona Lisa on there, right? Yes. And I was going to say, because this is a audio medium, so people don't know this. But yeah, I mean, fashion and style is a way we express ourselves. So creative expression is very much how we, signal our feelings, what we want people to see about ourselves. So I love that you said that about you. What I think is beautiful, I think, and I will end this and we'll say our goodbyes. What I think is beautiful is having a beautiful heart. I really do think that. I think if we're blind to suffering or other people's experiences, that does just prevent us from seeing the world and living fully. So having perspective and having exchanging of ideas and being culture makers, not just influencers. Like if there's something we don't like, we go out there and create a positive pathway for it, create that novel, create that film, create that communication tool guide, lead that webinar, produce those projects. I think that's one of the things women we do have is that we're great at multitasking and holding different spaces and leading those conversations and dialogues. And I think one of the things we all share communally is the fact that if we have the same mission in life, we can get along, right? And as long as we understand that, we hold space for one another. So I really appreciate every one of you taking out all this time today. It was one of our roundtables of this series, and we're going to have another set of dynamic women to finish this conversation on Wednesday. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. Yeah, thank you for your experience. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you.
If you enjoyed The Slow Dive, please subscribe and leave us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq, edited by Drew Franzblatt. Our theme song is Dive by Sarah. Thanks for listening.